History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And thankfully, they don't have to go untold, as long as some of us are willing to take just a couple simple steps. First, take the initiative to ask a few questions. And second, be willing to listen patiently as stories from long ago take on new life in the here and now. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to meet a very special member of that generation today, and you'll have the chance to meet him next month when he turns 100 years old during the Central Coast Air Fest in Santa Maria, California. That two-day air show is going to feature everything from World War II fighter planes to the latest F-35s. Even the Canadian Snowbirds are scheduled to perform. You can learn more at CentralCoastAirFest.com, and I have that linked for you at HometownHeroesRadio.com. But nobody's going to have a better time at that air show than Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California, a recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross for his actions as a P-38 Lightning pilot during World War II. His citation recognizes extraordinary heroism in action against the enemy near Aachen, Germany, 16 September 1944. While flying as rear man in a squadron of an armed reconnaissance mission, Lieutenant Kunkel noticed that his squadron was about to be surprised by a vastly superior force of enemy aircraft. Unable to summon his leader on the radio, he alone unhesitatingly pulled away from his formation and vigorously attacked the enemy, immediately destroying one of his aircraft. In doing so, Lieutenant Kunkel placed himself in a position to be attacked from the rear and above. When this attack materialized, many hits were registered on his aircraft, which caught fire, burning his face, neck, and hands. Despite his burning plane and the gunfire from enemy planes, Lieutenant Kunkel continued his attack against the vastly superior enemy force and succeeded in destroying a second enemy aircraft, breaking off combat only when forced to parachute to safety when his left fuel tank exploded. The heroism and aggressiveness displayed by Lieutenant Kunkel on this occasion reflect the highest credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States. So eventually, we're going to hear the story of that final mission for Jim Kunkel, but it always helps to put everything in context when we start at the beginning. And even though you've spent most of your life here in California, Jim, you're originally from Pennsylvania, right?
New Kensington, Pennsylvania. My dad was in the steel business. In 1932, he passed away. I was 9 years old. And before that, while we had been planning for him to retire, he was injured in World War I. And his great dream was to be an aviator in World War I. Unfortunately, he had this injury, and that was the end of that. But he passed away in 1932. My mother asked me if I wanted to go to California because we've been planning it. And so my mother took some driving lessons, and we came out 66. And the story is that she prayed her whole way to the California, and I pushed. So.
Well, and you're chuckling about it now, but I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. And boy, I mean, that sounds a little eye-opening and intimidating. And I'm curious about your father. You said he was injured in World War I.
Yes.
Is that something he told you about, what happened and everything?
I don't remember all the facts. He was injured on post, and it involved a Baldy rifle. And being a member of the National Rifle Association, I knew that we had some Baldy rifles. And he was in the hospital for quite a long time. So that was about the extent of it. He ended up with what they called an enlarging heart, which today they would think nothing of handling. But we were ready to leave for California, and he had a problem, and he went to the hospital in New York and never came back. So My mother was a goer. I mean, so it didn't slow her up too much. So we came to California for a year and then had to go back to Pennsylvania to settle the estate because my grandfather had died within 6 months of my dad. And so in the meantime, we spent a year in South Carolina, Spartanburg, South Carolina, and my mother had a business down there, and I got malaria, and they said to take me out of South Carolina. So we went back to Pennsylvania and then came to 1936. We came to California to stay.
You know, I'm thinking you beat a lot of odds in the mission where you earned the Distinguished Service Cross, but it sounds like you were dealing with some heavy stuff for your whole life before that. And I'm just interested because it affects everybody differently. But losing your father at such a young age, what was the impact of that on you?
I don't know that there was an impact. I know I missed my dad tremendously. He had instilled aviation in my thinking. Their steel company was a smaller company, and they did what they called electro castings. And a lot of those castings went into the aviation. And I remember we were up at Curtis Wright several times. I went through the Ford plant when I was 7 years old, where they were building trimotor Fords, and have photographs that were taken at that time. So when we came to California, my mother was very good about taking me. She'd take me out to the airport, and I visited every airport in Southern California and used to spend my weekends Saturday and sometimes even Sunday at Grand Central Air Terminal, working in anything you could do, wash airplanes, maybe get 10 minutes flying time, and that sort of thing. So we did a lot of that.
Well, and most guys that I have the privilege of meeting who've been involved in aviation as long as you have seem to have a place where it started, and you've talked about your father passing that on to you, that love of aviation. But do you remember the first time that you got to get off the ground and get in the air?
I think I was pretty young. We'd go someplace, and if there was an airplane close by that my dad could rent for a few days, including the pilot, he did not fly, we'd be up riding around in it. And I think, if I remember correctly, it was an early Travel Air. Probably one of the real early ones was my first flight. And then it was a number of flights and Travel Airs and Walkos and Stinsons. And so we had a home, we lived in New Kensington, but we had a home up in Bedford, Pennsylvania, summer home. So there was a little airport there that was pretty active and still is to this day. They had an enormous hotel there called Bedford Springs Hotel, and that attracted a lot of people. And so whoever the operator was at Bedford in those early days, he did pretty well.
Well, and you know a little bit about how that all works in that world. So you come out here as a child, you spend your teenage years in Southern California. Were you thinking all that time that flying is what you're going to do for your life, or what were your ideas?
I wanted to join the Air Force. I wanted to be a fighter pilot. We had an early friend by the name of Kelly, which happens to be my middle name. This was in Pennsylvania, and so he was a fighter pilot, and unfortunately he was killed in like 1931. But I had made up my mind that's the course I wanted to go. I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. Through all my schooling, that's where I was going. Well, the war interfered with that, and that was the end of it, really. I found out that I didn't want to work on a drafting table.
What you ended up doing was a little more dangerous, but you mentioned the war started. Do you have a memory of that day, December 7th, 1941?
I had a great big horse, and I'll go back another step before that. I was going to Beverly Hill High School in 1939. Of course, the war started in September, right at the beginning of the school year. So I went out at Grand Central Air Terminal. I'd met a number of people. The National Guard, the Air National Guard at that time, had a airfield in Griffith Park, directly across the river from Grand Central Air Terminal, which of course was a major terminal for Los Angeles in those days. I met this gentleman, and he was All-American at SC, and he was a brand new second lieutenant in the Air Guard, and he was working for Al Manasco, who owned Manasco Engines there in Glendale. He said, well, if you're so interested in aviation, why don't you come over to the Guard? We said, we got lots of openings over there. Of course, this was 1939, and I guess they weren't recruiting as easily as they did later. But so I joined the Air Guard, and I stayed with them up until the time I graduated from high school that summer of 1940. We were on maneuvers in Chehalis, Washington, 115th Observation Squadron. So the 115th is still part of the California Air National Guard. The Guard was interesting. I got some pretty nice flying from the back seat. And we had Douglas O-38s that were built in the early 30s. You know, we were really up to date. And we had a couple of O-47s, which were brand new from North American. They were had 1,000 horsepower and carried three people and weren't much good other than that. But that was my high school. I missed my prom. Actually missed my graduation at high school because we were on a field trip. But it was aviation, and that's where I was going to be.
One little side question here, because, you know, you talk about Beverly Hills High School, and people think of, you know, hoity-toity Los Angeles and Hollywood at the time and all that. Can you compare what Los Angeles was like in those days compared to what it's like now? I mean, would you run into movie stars on the street? Was that a big deal like it is now?
Yeah, you'd see them. That held true up through even after the war. Beverly Hills, you know, I've always said I know what it's like to be a minority because I didn't have a chauffeur drop me off at school. I took the streetcar. But other than that, Jackie Cooper was one of my classmates at Beverly Hills. Probably my best friend, who was Hank King, Henry King, and his dad was Henry King that made 12 O'Clock High and all of those motion pictures. And so I was on the fringe of the movie industry, but never had any desire to be involved in it in any way.
You had higher aspirations, no pun intended. So you're in the Guard. And you said you missed your prom and your graduation because of those requirements. So what about that Sunday morning? You said you were riding horses December 7th?
I had a big jumping horse, and I kept it at Dubrock Stables, which was at the corner of Los Feliz Boulevard and Riverside Drive. And there's a big fountain there now that they built. And I kept my horse there, and I met my future wife there when she was like 15. We were riding early in Griffith Park, and a guy who was some kind of a celebrity, was a singer, Johnny Johnson, came by and said, "Did you hear about Pearl Harbor?" So he was the one that told us. And of course, my first thought was, well, I had been released from the Air Guard because when they federalized the Guard, which they did in September 40, when we came back from the maneuvers in Washington, I wasn't 18 yet. So when they federalized, I couldn't go without my mother's permission. And she said, "Nope, you're going to finish your college and finish school and finish the college. And then if you want to be a fighter pilot, why, do it the right way." Then jump back in. And then the war started in Europe. I had some experience with the Guard. When the war started, you know, Pearl Harbor, the big deal was that they dropped the requirement of the 2 years of college, and they dropped the age limit to 18. So me and along with 500,000 other youngsters all ran down and joined up. We all wanted to be fighter pilots. So that's how that ended. But when I was in college, I started early. I went to a school called Cumnock for a short time, then went on to junior college. I decided that the summer of 1941, I worked at North American Aviation all of the summer. I got that job through the Air National Guard because some of our pilots were involved with North American. So I worked all that summer, and when school started, North American didn't have a graveyard shift, which I required. So I went to Lockheed, worked at 7th and Santa Fe downtown Los Angeles, where we built the wings and the empennage and the booms for the P-38 and the Hudson bomber. Go to work at 12 o'clock, be off at 7, and I'd be in school at 8:30. So it was a good active schedule.
Yeah, and maybe that explains why you're still in such great shape and so active. I don't think you ever slowed down. Maybe that's part of it. So you were building P-38s before you flew P-38s. You probably knew what a P-38 was before most people did, too. Was it love at first sight with that airplane?
Well, it was. We had several close friends who were engineers at Lockheed, so I knew about the airplane. And then working around Grand Central, we talked about celebrities. We had a number of them that flew, Robert Taylor, and gosh, I could probably name 10 or 12. Wallace Berry. I got a couple rides with him. He seemed to be a real nice guy. I knew several of the Lockheed test pilots even before I went to work for Lockheed. You know, the 38 in its day, you have to stop and remember, talking about the airplane, it was designed in 1937, the starting of the, when Kelly Johnson drew the first line on the paper. That development period took quite a long time. It was peacetime and nobody had any money, and Lockheed was not doing all that well, and so it took a long time to develop the 38. So they first flew it in 39, and then crashed it within a few hours on a cross country to setting a record, which I guess they were very thankful to do. So there was a lot of history behind that, and I kind of lived it. I was part of it. The being involved with Lockheed, I got the opportunity to work in the experimental hangar where they started the first Constellation and where Howard Hughes used to come in regularly. And so you'd see all these people, and it was just part of your life.
Just a couple things that come to mind here. One, I mean, I've heard the stories of how initially the P-38 had the props turning in the same direction and not counter-rotating like the ones you flew in Europe.
And then they found out they had some control problems. So they switched the props and made both of them critical, but we had lots of young guys who wanted to fly it, so there was no problem there.
And is it possible that there were P-38s that you flew in Europe that you had actually helped construct back in Southern California?
No, not in Europe. I flew 38s. I went through cadets. I ended up at Williams Field. Most of the 38 pilots came out of Williams Field. If you were one of the chosen few, we got to fly the 322, which was the P-38 without turbochargers, and the engines were actually, when the Air Force took them back, well, they did change the engine and the rotation of the prop, but we got 10 hours in that airplane before we graduated. So I did fly in airplanes that the first thing I'd do is go look for that tag up in the flap track, and I could tell whether I worked on that airplane or not. And of course, during my time there in the graveyard shift, I was an inspector. We inspected all the wings, and that's how I knew about the tag, and I had to stamp it. So yes, I did get a chance to fly, but they were all old war wearies by that time.
You know, and another thing that I don't want to gloss over or assume one way or another, but I've heard stories from people in Southern California right in the aftermath of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And it sounds like there was a palpable concern there that Los Angeles could be a target, that if you're working in an aircraft factory, that might be a place the Japanese want to hit. Do you remember any of that concern or suspicion?
Oh, yes. I have photographs of the Burbank plant and the camouflage that they did it. And of course, we remembered the Battle of Los Angeles when they turned on all of the searchlights and shut down the plant, and they were firing at something. They didn't have any idea what they were firing at. Probably some poor guy up there that was trying to find an airport. But they claimed they thought that they had Japanese aircraft over the city for a short time, I think. I think it was more panic than anything else. But yeah, we sat in blackout conditions in that plant most of the night. So a little blurb.
I mean, I'm just trying to picture myself in your shoes. That sounds a little scary.
Well, what was more scary, I had a good friend who rode his big stud horse from Texas to California, and he could tell these horror stories along the way. So that's how we spent the night. We weren't worried too much about somebody dropping a bomb.
And I guess I should have asked you, too, in your time in school in Southern California, had you had any friends who were Japanese-American?
Oh, yes. Yes, we did. And I went to Fairfax High first. Fairfax, we started in the ninth grade, so I was there for almost 2 years. And yes, there were a number of Japanese.
And I ask about the Japanese Americans because, you know, this is something that maybe we all have a different lens on in 2022 than you all had in 1942. Was it hard to understand what was happening to them in the months that followed Pearl Harbor?
I remember when they started collecting everybody and sending them out to Manzanar and places like that. I'm not sure I agreed with that. I think we were a little premature in some of that thinking, and I can understand it. I think there were some operatives from the Japanese military at Pearl Harbor, so there had to be a little espionage on the way that attack had been planned. But no, I didn't think that much of it. I think most of them were Americans. And the ones that I knew were gung-ho. And they certainly proved that later.
It's time for our first break, but there's so much more to come with 99-year-old Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California, a member of the Legion of Valor by virtue of the Distinguished Service Cross he earned 78 years ago this week in the skies over Aachen, Germany. You're going to have the chance to meet him at the Central Coast Air Fest in Santa Maria, California, where he'll celebrate his 100th birthday next month. Find more information at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California, originally from New Kensington, Pennsylvania. He worked on P-38s in a Southern California factory before flying P-38s against the Luftwaffe in World War II. You can meet Jim and wish him a happy 100th birthday next month at the Central Coast Air Fest in Santa Maria. Go to centralcoastairfest.com to get your tickets. I have that posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com as well. And Jim, a lot of people have that dream of becoming a fighter pilot, but there are a lot of hurdles you have to clear in the process of earning your wings and securing that kind of assignment. So I'm wondering if there were any bumps along that path for you.
I think I can honestly say I didn't breeze through it, certainly, but I went through pretty assured that I was going to get somewhere with it. I remember when we first took the test, we went out to the old, it was a big old type of resort kind of building on Grand Central Air Terminal where we took our exam. And I was a little concerned about that exam, but that worked out pretty much. I think they asked me, well, what preference did you have? Not that you're going to get it. They made that pretty clear, but I said, I want to fly P-38s, so I want to go to England. And I stuck with it the whole way through, and that's the way it ended up. And I think we started a few minutes ago backtracking on the P-38 being started, the design in 1937. The specifications that were laid out by the airport was for an interceptor aircraft. From a standing start to altitude to intercept bombers, attack the bombers and go back and land and rearm. And that's the way the airplane was conceived. And it turned out a lot different than that. Again, being privy to a lot of friends, people that I knew and people that I tried to encourage being a friend of mine, why we kept up with the design of the 38. And remember, the 38 was the first airplane to go 400 miles an hour, and it was the first airplane to do a lot of things, including diving into what we call compressibility, because we didn't know what Mach numbers were. The Mustang came along, but that wasn't in my time period. So all through the cadet program, I was pretty much aligned to the 38 because it was the best fighter we had at the time. Mustang was a wonderful airplane. B-47 was a wonderful airplane. But they came along later.
I thought for a second you were going to dip your toe in the 47 versus 51 debate, but I won't make you do that. And I know you did get some time in 51s later. But tell me about the P-38, because you're one of the last people still living who flew the P-38 in combat. What was it like to fly that plane? What did you enjoy about it?
Well, the airplane would do what you ask it to do. When I went to Europe, we weren't assigned to a particular group or squadron. I have been shooting for the 8th Air Force because it's air-to-air combat, long missions, but that's where the action ends. Sure. That's what I thought anyway. They sent me to the 9th Air Force, and before D-Day, I found out that the 9th Air Force is doing a hell of a lot of fighting that nobody was paying much attention to because it was all down where they could shoot at you. But the 38, no matter where you took it, at altitude, it was a great performer. We could actually put 6 500-pound bombs on it. We could carry 2 2,000-pound bombs if we could get them. Regularly carried 1,000-pound bombs and get off a short runway. So for a fighter airplane, we had the performance. 38 would outclimb a 51, it'll outclimb a P-47. And even after they gave the P-47 guys big Hamilton standard props so it could climb anywhere. And we gave the Mustang to the Packard folks to put an engine in. A 38 just soldiered along pretty much with Allisons and turbochargers, and we never got the big Hamilton standard propellers. It's a good story there, being involved at Lockheed and working part-time down in the experimental hangar. They brought in one of the early P-38, they converted it to what they called a P-38K. They put a different Allison engine in it, and they slowed the prop down, and they put the big Hamilton standard wide-blade, paddle-blade props on it. The airplane did so well, they actually built another one from scratch. The K was 40 miles an hour faster at altitude. It would climb to 45,000 feet. Outperformed the Mustang and the P-47 down Eglin Field. War Production Board that required a different engine, different prop, the design change in the engine mount and the cowling. War Production Board would not shut down the line long enough to make those changes. We never got the K. Mustang got the Merlin engine. The P-47 got the big props. We could have sure used those.
I never heard that before. So basically what you're saying is for all the accomplishments of the P-38 and the aces and the records, it could have been a much better airplane if they allowed those modifications to take hold?
Well, I wish in my final combat flight in the airplane, I wish I'd have had that extra few percent.
Yeah. And we're going to hear why you say that. But before we get to your last one, I'd love to hear about your first. So you guys were flying out of Andover, is that right?
Andover, England, 370th Fighter Group, 401st Squadron. Andover had been the old war college, RAF war college, so it was a big grass field, no runways. You could line up 3 or 4 or 5 or 8 line abreast and all go at the same time. And when you did, you went downhill and then you went uphill and then you went downhill again and then you got off the ground. But it was great for Spitfires, but it wasn't all the best for the 38, although we had the tricycle gear, which made a heck of a big difference. My first mission, it was kind of a quiet mission. We took off. The minute you're airborne, you start picking up the buzz of the German radar, so they know they're tracking you. We crossed the channel, and we intercepted some ground trucks. I was flying off of the squadron's operational officer, who was probably the most experienced combat pilot we had in the whole group. And so he went down and strafed the truck, and so I'm right on his wing, and I picked out my truck and strafed it and watched it fall apart. I had never fired all the guns on the P-38. Out over Catalina, I fired one gun out of the 150 out of the 4 and no cannon. And so when I pulled that damn trigger on that truck, I thought the airplane came to a sudden stop and was going to shake to pieces. Now, that was probably the most exciting thing out of the whole mission.
Did that get your heart pumping a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We took some fire from the ground, so we came back around and made a strafing run on what we thought was the position that they were firing upon us. You just had to be careful.
Was there a moment, and maybe you understood it ahead of time, but I'm just wondering if there was a moment where the stakes of what you were doing became clear, where it became not just an idea, but a palpable thought that you could die doing this?
Well, yeah, I think you could figure that one out, although, you know, it usually happens to the other guy. It doesn't happen to you. I think that's the old thought. You know, I wanted to go to England because at the early part of the war, the English were taking a hell of a beating. And so I guess my thought was, well, let's get over there and help them out. When I arrived in England, just being associated with those people and being in London when they had a blackout, even before I joined the squadron, on the way to the squadron, we were experienced some of that in London. And so you had the thought, well, I don't remember thinking of it as being a crusade, but I thought we were on somebody's list to accomplish something. So I never thought too much about, you know, dying. I think I was more worried about doing a good job. Some of my early missions, I could have used more experience than I had.
Well, sounds like I need to ask you about that. You said the Great Crusade. Of course, that's famously what Eisenhower said on D-Day as part of his speech to everybody. And I'm wondering, as I again try to imagine being you as this young fighter pilot, what you shared about your father, that his dream had been to be a fighter pilot. Were there times in the cockpit of that P-38 where you thought about your dad?
Oh, yes. Yep. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was 9 when he died, and I don't think there was ever a day I didn't think about him. But then you miss him. But my mother bent over backwards to raise me right, I guess. Sometimes I reneged on doing certain things because I didn't want to worry her, but she backed me all the way.
And you said something there a second ago. You said that on some of your early missions, you could have used a little more experience. So it sounds like you learned a few things the hard way.
Well, they didn't tell us too much about dive bombing. So I figured out that it's a little bit like witchcraft. You roll over and you try, well, I'll put this pipper on the target and then I'll pull through 2 radii and I'll release. And the damn bomb would drop someplace else. And so you learn by experience. We really didn't get much training here in the States. You got about 100 hours on the P-38. There's a rock on the north end of Catalina, and we used that as a target. And we dropped these little tiny bombs with a shotgun shell in them to make a puff of water. I don't think very many people hit the rock. Just had to build the experience of working it out for yourself. Sometimes you close your eyes on the dive so you don't see the plaque. That's one good advantage. And so you don't flinch. Bomb went where it was going to go. Actually, it took, you know, 8, 10, 12 missions to begin to feel like you were earning your pay.
And I think I read that at, you know, in some intense sequences or periods there, I mean, there were days where you were going up 3 or 4 times a day?
Yeah, that happened. Not all the time, but usually you split the squadron. We'd alternate the missions. And that was more for our ground crew. Those guys were working all night to get an airplane ready to get the bejesus shot out of it and bring it back. The scheduling worked out well. Every once in a while, we might get hit with 2 or 3 missions in one day. And I had some of my most exciting missions that very occurrence.
Well, I can't let that comment go by without asking you what made them so exciting.
Well, you know, we moved out of Andover and we went to A1. When we moved in there, now we're much closer to the lines and our missions were shorter. Within takeoff, 10 minutes later, you're over the enemy territory. So we were running missions that normally would have, flying the channel would be 2.5-3 hours. We're doing them in an hour. The one thing about the 9th Air Force that I learned very quickly was that we were in support of our ground troops. Mm-hmm. And so you, all of a sudden, you realize that, sure, it's nice to shoot down an enemy airplane or contest the air with an enemy fighter, but if you're helping those GIs down on the deck, very beneficial. And they certainly appreciated it, even in the mistakes we made when we might scrape them, or we had a few occurrences like that where there's just no way you could identify your target. If they shot at us, why, we shot back. Sometimes they were shooting a little bit early. We felt that we were helping their efforts, and God knows they were doing a big job right from the day that morning of the 7th on through.
Well, and I've talked to some of those guys who've given, you know, an anonymous P-38 a lot of credit for saving their bacon on the ground when they were in some tough spots. You mentioned flak a moment ago. How consistent was that? I mean, is it the kind of thing where every time you fly, something's going to be coming up at you?
Well, yes. In the 9th Air Force, we got a lot of ground flak. And there was no way to fly over occupied France and Normandy without crossing over some type of flak equipment. So you never knew when you were going to get hit. Flak, they were pretty doggone accurate. I've been in a dive bombing run and had usually the 88s with big black puff. And the 88s, you think more being up with firing at the B-17s at 25,000. I've been in a dive bombing run and I'd have three bursts right off my wing. They weren't in line, but they were sure as hell on my altitude, and I'm diving.
Yeah.
So the Germans were very proficient with their anti-aircraft. The 40s and the 20 millimeter, you could see those things coming at you, so you knew it. And then the 30 caliber, well, that's one reason I didn't care much for the Mustang early on. They could throw a rock at you, and with the right hit, you're done. But the 38, at least we had another engine to come home on. The flak was heavy. But when I talked to these Navy guys and Air Force guys that flew in Vietnam, they had flak like we never even dreamed of having. So I guess it's all in you doing what you do. But we were moving a heck of a lot slower.
What perspective we're picking up today from P-38 pilot Jim Kunkel, but we haven't yet explored the mission that earned him the Distinguished Service Cross. We might end up needing another episode to squeeze all of that in. I'm going to keep mentioning this because I really hope you take this suggestion to heart. The Central Coast Air Fest is October 15th and 16th in Santa Maria, California. If you're listening on our affiliate, KSMA in Santa Maria, I'm sure you already know all about the historic aircraft that are going to be coming. But this history-making World War II pilot is going to be there too, and he turns 100 during the air show. Go to centralcoastairfest.com to get your tickets and make sure to find Jim when you go. I have that information linked for you as well at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll have more with this amazingly sharp and resilient survivor when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website? That's simple. CVTR.com for Central Valley Trailer Repair. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode that is flying by just way too quickly today with Jim Kunkel. I have a feeling we're going to have to continue this conversation into another episode. We don't often do that, but I know you can hear and feel why that's probably going to be necessary with Jim and his story. You'll have the chance to wish him a happy 100th birthday next month at the Central Coast Air Fest in Santa Maria, California. You may even see a P-38 Lightning like the ones Jim flew in Europe. You know, we've got to talk about your last mission, and I mean, I can't believe I'm sitting here talking to you because I don't know how you survived and how you didn't become a prisoner and how you're still going strong at 100. But before that last mission, were there some other close calls that kind of stand out in your memory that got your attention a little bit, or you said, hey, that almost was my number coming up?
Well, actually, you kind of get accustomed to getting hit. Every time you come in, there'd be a hole in the airplane someplace. Some of our big missions were like we had the German 7th Army trap in the Pilates Gap. It was carnage what we were doing to the Germans. But you're right down on the deck. I can remember when, I think it was the third mission of the day, and the last minute, we were still at A1. Well, at A1, we had what they called 11 o'clock curfew. They shut the beachhead down at 11 o'clock, and any aircraft that's flying is now an enemy aircraft. And we actually lost one of our pilots that way. He was coming back on single engine. He was in the landing pattern with landing lights on and recognition lights on, and our guys opened up on him. So we had experiences like that. Some of the missions that I flew, the Germans changed their tactics on. All of a sudden, they seemed to become more interested in the Jabos or the fighter bombers. We had several occasions with the P-38s that were hit pretty hard. And usually it would be a day with cumulus cloud, probably scattered. We'd be on a target, and we had four-channel VHF. We had no navigation equipment. You couldn't pinpoint anything on the ground except visually. So you're looking for your target, and the Germans would vector the Luftwaffe around. First thing you knew, they were on your 6 o'clock coming in on you. And if you didn't pick them up, why, it got real serious. We had one of our P-38 groups that lost half a squadron from that very thing. They hit them, and they didn't know they were going to be hit, and it was chaos. That was in August, and then one of our squadrons in our group got hit pretty hard. They only lost 4. So we decided that we're going to put some experience on the back end of the squadron instead of putting all of the new guys on somebody's wing and in the aft elements. So we'll put some experience back there. So I several times drew the deal, and in August we were looking for a target. Somebody yelled black in the group, didn't identify themselves, so I don't know who it was or what even it was our squadron. I'm checking my 6 o'clock, and here comes a couple of round engines flat on the wing, got to be a 190. They're boring in on us. Well, at the same time, I called the brake and made the brake. The squadron kept on going. And at the same time, from about a 45-degree angle, they got hit. I'm back there with two FW-190s going around in a big circle, checking my 6 o'clock and pulling all the Gs I could pull because I had a pretty good idea where they were. And I looked around in front of me, and I had the rudder post of a 190. And on a P-38, you could see your top 250s through the gun sight. And it looked like I had them right around his rudder post. I was right on top of him. And before, I think I got a burst in before, but he did a flick roll like I've never seen. He outrolled my 38 6-1. Wow. And rolled away from me. I'm halfway through the roll trying to stay with him. The leader crossed in front, so he could have nailed me real easy. But apparently he was more interested in sticking with his leader. That was my warning sign. That son of a gun could have got me. Wow. So, and I did not get him. 90 days later, we had the P-38Ls starting to show up, and they had aileron boost, and I could have rolled with that son of a gun. So that was my first enemy aircraft that I saw, but I didn't prevail.
This interview with Distinguished Service Cross recipient Jim Kunkel was made possible because of a good friend of mine, Peter Mercino, who flew me to Jim's hangar at the Santa Ynez Airport, along with the master pilot who taught Peter how to fly, Harold Gallagher. Harold is a veteran who recently returned from Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight, Peter serving as his guardian. So I had two pilots sitting in on the interview with this legendary aviator, and Harold wanted to know from Jim if there was any singular American airplane that was considered most feared by German forces during World War II.
That's a good question. I've heard both stories. In fact, I just read an article by this German. He was down in Italy, and the 38 did real well in Italy. He thought the 38 was the most dangerous airplane he had come up again. He was one of their top aces, who later became Air Marshal of the Luftwaffe. Heard stories from and talked with Luftwaffe pilots who thought the 38 was kind of a dog. There's a whole lot of reason behind this. I think when the 38s, remember, we were having such a horrible time with the B-17s. The P-47s were taking them halfway to the target, and then they had to go home. And so they took four P-38 groups, sent them to England with not very much experience. They didn't do well because at that time, this was just before Jimmy Doolittle took over the 8th Air Force. At that time, the fighters had to stay with the bombers. You had no choice in pursuit. If you got on the tail of an enemy aircraft and he dove away from you, you couldn't follow him. You had to break the combat and go back to protect those bombers. Doolittle was the one that finally recognized the fact that you had to destroy those fighters before D-Day. And so the only way you're going to destroy them is have free fire and to go after them. So he spread the groups out, and it was no more of this. Well, the 38 never got the benefit of those later days. And we had trouble with the British gasoline. The Allison engine did not like the heavy lead in the British fuel that we were using. We had some turbo problems, and one of the big problems with 38, we didn't have any heat in the cockpit. That gets damn cold at altitude to the point that you're almost immobile. So we didn't have that engine in front of us. All we had was those open gun bays with all that cold air coming in. But again, the 38 soldiered through all of that, and they did give some protection to the bombers, and I think some of the heavy guys appreciated it. It was tough going for particularly the winter of 43 and early 44. They had the big week. Well, the Mustang was just coming into its own. The P-47 was doing a good job, but they couldn't go far enough.
We probably all heard that nickname that some Germans gave it at one point, too, for the P-38, the fork-tailed devil. Did you hear that a time or two?
Oh, I've heard that one. I heard it from particularly the people who were strafing. You talk about the benefits of the 38. You had your four guns in that cannon right in front of you in a circle about like that. There's no converging fire, which crossed it maybe wherever you set it, 300 yards, whatever you wanted. But once it meets to the conversions point, then it starts spreading out beyond that point. 38, we could kick the nose up and we could lob those shots in on a ground target. We could be firing at 1,000 yards and hit something. And so you got their heads down before you got there. I always thought that was a great benefit. And the other benefit was you had two engines. If you were hitting a ground target, if you're not firing, that ball is over in the corner. So it looks like you're going one way and you're actually going the other. Anything to help. Other than that, I think all three of our fighters, we were well mounted.
I know I could sit here all day asking you questions, and we've had an hour fly by already, but I haven't even talked to you about that last mission, which in many ways has impacted your life. What was the date of that, and what was the target? And walk me through that.
16th of September, 5:45 in the evening. You know, we were out of fuel. We'd overrun our supply lines. We were short on fuel, and so finally we put together this this mission, and we were going up into Stuttgart, and we were flying full group, three squadrons, 16 aircraft per squadron. Again, I drew the Purple Heart corner. back in the back. It was my turn. And so that was fine. But then I lost my wingman because of fuel. And so we're on our way to Stuttgart. At our target picked out, the 1st Infantry Division was trying to take Aachen in early September. And it was the first big German city that we tried to on an attack basis. And so we get this call from the controller that they had a hot target. And it was the Germans were trying to reinforce Aachen, and they were putting all these ground troops in railroad any way they could get them. So we had our basic mission was that two of the squadrons would go down and strafe, dive bomb and strafe, and our squadron would fly top cover for them because we were having this problem with the Luftwaffe hitting our guys when they least expected. So we're up there over Aachen. At that time, I think if they'd have taken the damn seat out and turned it around, it would have been a lot. And it, you could fly looking over your shoulder, but it was too damn hard to see those guys coming in on you. Sure enough, here they came. I can see them today. They were coming in at about a 45-degree break. Two different goggles coming at us, and they were coming around a cloud. They were heading right for the group. And so I very carefully called the break. I remember being momentarily hesitating till I got everything, my voice under control. And I called the break, and I made the break. Well, you know, the axiom of a fighter group is that whoever sees the enemy first, don't take your eyes off them because they're so easy to lose. Whoever sees them first leads the attack. So I had no problem with that. I'm leading the attack. All of a sudden, I picked out the group to the left because the 38 turned better to the left. This other group came around, and all of a sudden, I'm starting my pass at the lead aircraft, and all of a sudden I'm getting shot to hell from behind. I figured there should be a squadron behind me, and it's not there. So then it just became a real, what they nowadays these youngsters call it, a fur ball. It was just full power in a big rat race.
Can you imagine yourself in that scenario? One P-38 up against approximately 20 enemy fighter planes? How in the world are we actually talking to Jim Kunkel if those were the odds he faced? And how might that compare to some of the overwhelming situations you're encountering in your own life? I really hate to do this to you, but you're going to have the next week to think about it because we're out of time for this week. We will explore every aspect of that mission that earned Jim the Distinguished Service Cross next time on Hometown Heroes. I'll encourage you one more time before we go. Circle October 15th and 16th on your calendar. That is the Central Coast Air Fest in Santa Maria, California, and that's where Jim is going to celebrate birthday number 100. Why not try to find him there and thank him for serving our country? I want to thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time because we can't wait to share the rest of Jim Kunkel's incredible story of survival with you as we're all reminded again together that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their Wall of Honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that Wall of Honor.